people don't equate the risk to the yield. And that's the big thing that investors miss. They're buying these high yield instruments because they're marketed as high yield, but the yield is the risk. That's your compensation for risk you're taking. And is it really worth 4% to lose half your money or more?
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap. Here with my good friend Lance Roberts. Lance, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, and so it's good. It's been an interesting week, so we'll see how it goes from here.
Yeah, and folks, we are recording this. This is a truncated week for two reasons. One, we had Monday off for the U.S. July 4th holidays, and also we're recording this at the end of the day on Wednesday, because Lance is heading off out of the country on a well-deserved vacation.
And thanks a lot. And so about this time that you're watching this, I'm probably on the beach somewhere. So we'll see, you know, how this all turns out. But yeah, very excited. We haven't seen our son in a couple of years. So this is good because of COVID and restrictions and lockdowns. He lives in Germany. So we've decided to all kind of meet up in Italy for a few days just to kind of get caught back up and, you know, see our long lost departed son.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Have a good time. Vacation, extremely well-deserved. I know you're only going for a week, Lance, which honestly I think is criminally short for how hard you work. So I hope somewhere in there you do find some time to relax on that beach, especially because I'm going to be pulling you back in on Monday to do our monthly live Q&A, where you and the guys at New Harbor answer any and all questions that our audience has. So I know we're going to be encroaching a bit on your vacation already.
It's all right. I mean, there may be a few pizza stains on my shirt, but other than that, that'll be just completely fine.
But that's kind of normal anyways, right?
Exactly.
All right. Well, look, so short week so far. Markets are up so far this week. But the big news, at least today, is that the Fed minutes were released for the previous June meeting. And, everybody's dissecting those minutes as we speak here. It looks like, no surprise, the Fed was worried about inflation, the inflation that they helped create. I think if anything, people are maybe thinking, the Fed's maybe they're pretty serious about doing whatever it takes here to bring inflation down. Of course, a lot of discussion right now as to whether Powell is going to fully deliver on the rate hikes the Fed has already announced yet this year or not. But what are you thinking so far looking at the minutes here?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, two things is, first of all, is that, you know, how could the guy who is running the Federal Reserve and surrounded by literally hundreds of PhD economists have gotten inflation so terribly wrong? And just recently came out, basically admitted, you know, hey, you know, we didn't get it right. You know, I'm just, you know, that kind of bothers me a little bit because, you know, you and me and, you know, people on the Wealthion channel, we were all saying, hey, inflation's going to come when you inject the economy with this much money and shut the economy down. It's basic economics. In fact, I'm writing an article on this right now and just showing the basic economic graph of supply and demand and what happens to price when you shift demand and shorten supply. So, you know, the outcome was not surprising of what we're involved with. What was most surprising is that he just really didn't get it, or at least acts like he didn't get it. And, you know, we talked about this before. I don't know if that's just something he's saying or if he really means it. And if he really means it, that scares me probably more than anything else.
Yeah, I was just, searching online, trying to find the actual quote he said, but it was kind of mind-boggling. It was something like, we've only recently learned how much we don't understand or we don't know yet about inflation. Yeah. Something like that. You're like, are you serious? Like, exactly. If anybody should understand the mechanics of that, it should be the U.S. Federal Reserve with its army of PhDs and its, you know, role of basically being the inflation fighter. And the fact that they're basically just saying like, yeah, we really kind of didn't know what we were doing when, like you said, Lance, I think anybody, you know, sort of with like fifth grade math skills, you know, could look at the 10 plus trillion in combined monetary and fiscal stimulus that was being pumped into the system and saying, you know, this is going to impact prices probably in an inflationary way. I mean, it's not super hard. So anyways, yeah, it is a bit undermining of one's faith in the grand captain of, you know, our monetary system here. All right. Well, look, so just to sort of reiterate some of the things that I teased out of those minutes. One, the Fed did confirm that it's concerned about inflation, very concerned about it becoming, quote unquote, entrenched. Right. I mean, they use words like well anchored and entrenched and whatnot. And oftentimes they use them in ways where you're like, I'm not sure that word means
what you think it means.
Yeah. Like, you know, oh, it's transitory. And it's like, I think I have a different definition for that than you guys.
Cool quote from The Princess Bride. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. classic movie. In there, they say that the committee does see that inflation risks are, quote, skewed to the upside right now. And they see that risks to the economy and economic growth are skewed to the downside. So I don't think we would disagree at this point in time necessarily. I mean, I think, you know, we have our big call out there that we're going to start seeing disinflation pretty soon. But again, folks, that doesn't mean we think that inflation is suddenly going to go away. We just think its rate of increase is going to slowly start decreasing here, right? And other smart people who we've interviewed on this channel, I think, largely agree with us on that. But we'll see. The data will come out pretty soon. But you think, all right, you know, they're worried about persisting high inflation. They're worried about slowing economy. Well, I mean, that kind of equals stagflation. You look at all the data that's going on right now, the economy continues to slow. More and more economists are saying, hey, the risk of inflation is growing. I know the risk of recession is growing. And I know you're a little worried about that, Lance, because you think that, you know, most recessions haven't been as well telegraphed as this one. And with everybody getting in that side of the boat, you're a little bit nervous, but I don't know. So are we headed for a stagflationary second half to this year?
Yeah. And I think there's two points. One is that, you know, if the Fed got inflation so wrong, I'm not so sure they're getting inflation going forward right either, right? I mean, how much confidence can you have in their forecast? And if you take a look at their, you know, quarterly updates that they have to inflation and GDP, I mean, these are the worst economic forecasters on the planet. If anybody else had a job where they got paid to forecast and were as bad as the Fed, they would have lost their job already.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you'll find this really funny. I just interviewed David Hay from Evergreen GovCall just the other day. The interview is going to be coming out probably right before this one. And he pulled out a stat that said that the Fed's projections, they basically have a 37% accuracy in their forecasting, which is terrible in this space, right? And so I made the quote that what the Fed should do is they should do just a little bit more QE, that basically they should just print up a new quarter and start flipping that quarter when they make decisions, because it'll automatically increase their accuracy from 37% to 50%.
Yeah. You would think that, you know, this is, and again, it goes back to the whole conversation, which is these are the people running our monetary policy in our country. And, you know, they're missing the big points. And, you know, and what cracks me up even more is when they talk about wealth inequality. Mm. You caused it. You know, 90% of the stock market is owned by the top 10% of income earners. You caused it because that gap inflated ever since 2009 when you started QE, which was intently your purpose, was to boost asset prices, which eventually it basically acts as a wealth transfer mechanism from the middle class to the wealthy. And you know, they act all surprised that they caused this problem. And, you know, so, you know, the idea they're going to fix something is, you know, through their policy, and the fact that people give them so much credit that they can actually control inflation or economic growth or fix, you know, what ails the economy is mind-boggling to me. I mean, Janet Yellen talking about the fact the Treasury needs to be more focused on climate change is ridiculous, but, you know, that's where we've gotten to, you know, ultimately. And so back to your original question is there's two things to focus on from here. One thing I'm getting a lot of emails on is like, Lance, man, the market's down 20% this year. When's the Fed going to start bailing out equity prices, right? And that's kind of an interesting point because, you know, if you take a look at asset allocations of individual investors, they haven't gone down, right? They're still very near record levels in terms of asset allocations to equities. Now, normally in a bear market, you would see a much higher allocation to cash and a much lower allocation to equities. That's not occurring. But sentiment if we take a look at sentiment measures really across the board, they're as bearish as they can get. So it's very interesting because everybody's terrified of the markets, but they're not selling anything.
Right. They're not doing what they're saying yet. Right.
Yeah. Because they're afraid that they're going to miss out if the Fed turns around tomorrow and says, oh, it's over, right? We're going to start doing QE again. They don't want to miss the bottom. And it's a very interesting psychological, you know, kind of measure of the market of what's going on. It's the, you know, the fear of loss, right? That loss aversion metric hasn't kicked in yet because everybody's the fear of missing out is overriding the fear of loss aversion. And that's a very interesting kind of conundrum for the markets where the Fed's put us. But a lot of people have been emailing me saying, you know, when's the Fed going to bail it out? Here's the interesting thing about that. There is a very high correlation between Fed bailouts and earnings contractions, more so than there is the Fed bailout price. In other words, the Fed really doesn't focus on price as a function of doing QE. Their main focus is on earnings reversion. So when you have a big impact to earnings, that's where the Fed gets a lot more concerned about the market, the economy, et cetera. Why, of course, as you and I have talked about before, is because they've broken something at that point. And there's either a credit risk to corporations or corporations are crying to Uncle Sam for a bailout because they spent all their money on buybacks, as we saw in March of 2020. Boeing's like, oh, I can't afford to survive. Give me some money. Well, if you hadn't spent 5 years of spending all your profits on buybacks, you would have had some cash for a downturn. Different story. Another rant for another day.
Right. Although you're reinforcing your earlier point about the wealth transfer.
Right, exactly. But so that's one of the big things. And that's the interesting thing. I've been writing a lot about this lately. And something I've got coming up this weekend's newsletter is particularly talking about, we have not seen the reversion to earnings yet, but it's coming. And I think it's coming a lot sooner than we expect, which is going to be problematic for the Fed trying to continue to hike rates. Because when we start seeing those earnings revert back to lower levels, the market will get dragged down in price to justify those valuation changes. And the Fed's going to have to get more concerned about exactly how far they can hike rates. So, you know, I think the Fed's about to run into a very difficult position over the next quarter.
All right. Well, that was my next note here, which is, do you still feel like I do, and we have talked a lot about recently, particularly last week, about how the next big shoe to drop here is going to be the earnings calls that are going to start in the next week or two, where corporate America is going to be, you know, releasing its Q2 earnings, but more importantly, giving its latest projections for future earnings. And given the deceleration that we're seeing in the economy, given that the demand destruction we're seeing because of both high prices, but also the Fed raising the cost of capital, highly likely that they're going to be revising their earnings down, and probably substantially down relative to where current earning forecasts are. And you're nodding as I'm saying this, and this is basically what you were saying earlier. So I just want to, I want to really just make it clear for folks that that's a big event that's coming up. Well, Will it have the effect that we think? We're going to find out. But
anyway, well, let me just. I was just going to say it's very interesting. In the month, so about every month, I download all the S&P earnings data from the S&P website, and I kind of keep a track on it quarter over quarter as to what's happening with earnings. And, you know, I've been downloading it more often to look at it because I'm waiting for this reversion in earnings to start to show up at S&P, right? So the analysts start to bring down those earnings. I was shocked to find out that in the month of June, now, remember, in the month of June, markets are down 20%. The economy is showing clear signs of a recession. You know, we're seeing just across the board, you know, manufacturing, economic indicators, et cetera, all turn lower. And S&P actually increased their earnings estimates going out for companies by, you know, roughly for 2024, the end of 2024, those earnings estimates actually went up by $2 a share to $242 a share. But every quarter from here till then also was revised higher. So despite the fact that we're seeing this economic slowdown and seeing this impact of what's going on in the economy, S&P is still increasing their earnings, expecting that somehow magically we're not going to have an earnings reversion or what we call an earnings recession in the economy. So, but the basic reality is that if the economy falls into a recession, earnings are going to go into a recession. You will have negative earnings growth during a recession. That's just a function of time. And generally, that correction is somewhere between 15 and 20%.
Right. So, I mean, that blows my mind, Lance. You know, analysts are loath to revise their projections, especially like because of a secular turn in the markets. They want to see sort of the whites of that turn's eyes before they really start doing it. But at this point, I can't think of any reason, any logical reason why they would not only continue resisting, but increase them over the past month. I mean, is there some argument that I'm missing here?
Yeah, so it was interesting. There was a MarketWatch article out, don't quote me on the day, I think it was Tuesday, talking about that we're probably going to have two quarters of negative earnings growth. But that doesn't mean we're in a recession because employment remains very strong. And, you know, it's an interesting kind of dichotomy because they're going, well, look at how strong jobs are, right? We're still creating all this employment growth. And by the way, we've got the jobs report out on Friday. So, you know, we've got this very strong jobs growth. And so that's going to keep everybody out of the recession because everybody can keep spending because everybody still has a job. The problem with that logic is that employment is a big lagging indicator. And it changes like that. I mean, you know, employment doesn't go kind of gradually up. When it goes to unemployment, it tends to spike straight up. And more importantly, we have lots of that data is massive negative revisions to it. You know, we'll get a year from now and they'll come back and they'll say, oh yeah, that 400,000 a month in job growth we had. Yeah. It was like 50.
Right.
You have these massive revisions to this data. So I think it's very hard, you know, or very challenging to suggest that employment is going to keep us out of a recession when that data is so lagging.
Well, yeah. And just on that. So, I mean, you and I have talked a lot in recent videos here about the worsening data in the job market. So I won't repeat it, but job freezes at many of the biggest employers in the country, tech layoffs, you know, back to where they were back during, you know, April of 2020, when we were shutting down the whole global economy, right? So there's already a fair amount of bad news developing and building steam quickly there. But let's just assume for a minute that it just stays flat, right? Employment just stays flat. You've had this massive increase in the cost of living, right? So, you know, the real wages are going down. So people have the ability, those employed workers have the ability to buy less than they did before. You would think that alone would bring down earning estimates, right? Because consumer spending is 70% of GDP. Then you factor in, you know, the job softening, job losses that a real recession would have. I mean, it boggles my mind that they could justify increasing their earnings for next year.
Well, you know, and what's also important about employment is that we're not even back to where we were job-wise in March of 2020.
Right.
So, you know, all we've done, and this is a kind of a key factor, right? We're calling it job growth. It's not job growth. It's job replacement because we laid off all these people. And then all we've done is put people back to work. We haven't accounted for 2 years of population growth that don't have jobs, right? And so this is and we talked on this show about, you know, the anomalies that occur inside of the employment data, you know, the birth death adjustment, and there's all these kind of, you know, one-off measures that really just don't make a whole lot of sense. But again, we talk about jobs, right? All we're doing is replacing all the jobs that we laid off during the pandemic. We're not creating new jobs. We're just replacing the jobs that we had previously. And we're not accounting for all that population growth we've had since then. So the real economy is substantially weaker than what a lot of this data suggests. And I suspect that as we get into 2023, 2024, and we go back and do our 3-year annual revisions, that we'll find out that the economic growth wasn't nearly as strong as we thought it was.
Yeah. And the thing that bugs me about this is everything we're saying here, this is not rocket science, right? I mean, this is something, that Powell's PhDs should certainly know, but it's something that a Wall Street analyst should be able to know, too. This isn't super esoteric. So I've just made a note to myself here. We hopped over last week the trades that you guys have been making there at Real Investment Advisors. Right. So we got 2 weeks worth of catching up on that to do. So I want to let folks know I am going to ask you that in just a moment. Before I do, though, we're just entering into a topic I wanted to go a bit into in this video. We mentioned it super briefly last one and said, let's get deeper into it in this one, because it's an important component of what you're talking about here. So we're talking about the decline in consumer demand that could pinch margins and create an earnings recession, right? The other big thing that would do the same thing for corporations in terms of pinching their margins is what the Fed is doing. It's the rising cost of capital. In fact, it's what the Fed and what the market is doing. It's the rising cost of capital. Yep. And again, when I say those words, I don't know how much they really mean to the average person, but basically it means that the cost of, well, of capital, but mostly in this case, the cost of debt is rising. So our economy is fueled by credit. It's just the way that it's structured. Companies live and breathe credit. They need it. It's the oil that makes the gears of our economy move. And that credit is becoming more expensive. Now, as the Fed raises the federal funds rate, which a lot of other debt is priced against, that increases the cost of that capital. And as markets get nervous about the future's prospect, they raise yields on the further end of the credit curve. So why this is important is, first of all, if you're a company and you need credit, well, you've had a great 10 years because you've been able to borrow credit for almost nothing, right? It's almost an unlimited amount of credit for almost free. Who wouldn't love that, right? And companies bought their stock back in records amount. It was never a problem to get working capital. All of a sudden, you're in a situation now where it's more expensive to be able to do that. So first off, companies can't just buy back their shares willy-nilly, which you and I have talked about has been a massive supporter of increase in stock prices over the past decade, but they just can't fund working capital as well. And as we've mentioned, like 20% of corporations in America are what are called zombie corporations, which is they have to borrow just to meet their interest payments on their existing debt. Well, if their debt costs go up, it gets harder for them to do that. And that puts them in jeopardy of actually from turning into zombies and just from the undead to just the plain old dead, right?
Exactly.
So the other element that's important to say about cost of capital too is the way in which stocks are valued. One of the time-honored ways in which they're valued is on what's called a discounted cash flow basis, which is you look at the earnings of a company, and because future earnings, you're having to wait years to get them and there's more risk involved before you get them, you have to discount them back to a present value to add them all up and then come up with what you think the company's future stream of earnings is worth. And that's one way to value a company. You discount that cash flow stream at what's called the weighted average cost of capital. And so what you input there is basically what it costs you to issue stock and to take on debt. And then that rate, that blended rate is called your discount rate. That's what you discount those future streams on. So as the cost of capital goes up, that discount rate gets higher and it brings down the value of future earnings. And so just mathematically, stock prices have to come down just from that alone, right? So I hope I made sense there for folks, Lance. I see you smiling as I'm saying a lot of this, but are you getting this the way that I do, which is just cost of capital goes up, stock prices have to come down. And yet, even though they've come down a fair amount this year, as we look to those earnings projections, et cetera, it seems like a big part of the market still hasn't really gotten the message yet about this.
No, and they haven't. And, you know, the reason I was smiling is I'm sitting there going, and, you know, Adam's so cute. He actually believes that fundamentals matter in this market.
I know.
But, you know, but the reality is, you know, and look, it's been this way for years. You know, it's been a function where, you know, fair market valuations and kind of fundamental market values and these type of things have been non-existent because it's been all about the Fed, right? And every time the Fed shows up, you just start buying equities because they're, you know, putting QE in the markets. And this is what I was saying earlier. This is what everybody's waiting on. Nobody's willing to sell. Nobody's looking at valuations right now. Everybody's simply just looking, because if they were all looking at valuations, A, earnings would be coming down and prices would be down a lot more than they are. Okay. So that's how you know kind of what's going on. But if you take a look at, for instance, stock buybacks, they're right now we're running at a record pace of stock buyback announcement for this year. So corporations with no better alternative for capital, they're just turning back to the one thing they know how to do to boost their equity prices, which is where they get their stock option compensation from. And that's to do stock buybacks. And that's been 40%. We've talked about this before. Since 2011, 40% of the advance of the market since 2011 has been solely due to stock buybacks. So without stock buybacks, the market's around 2,500, 2,600, not 4,000, right? 4,500. So, right. You know,
now you that, say stock buybacks, I sort of hear legalized theft, but yeah, go on.
Yeah. It's the same thing. It's just a different, you know, it's kind of like high yield versus junk bonds, right? It's just a marketing term. So, you know, but the impact is that we've totally moved the market away from, you know, doing basic analysis, discounted cash flow analysis, you know, or any other type of fundamental analysis. You know, that's the problem that the Fed has created. And if the Fed would just stay out of the market for a while longer, we may actually get back to where market fundamentals matter. I'm not sure if that's going to be the case or not, but we're starting to move back into the realm where I'm actually starting to see people actually talk about basic fundamentals for the first time in years. So, you know, maybe this is not such a bad thing that we're having going on right now. I know, well, it's painful, you know, but well, it's not a
bad
thing.
Boys can dream. Yeah,
exactly.
who knows what will happen? I'm glad you mentioned high yield, just because it's a great example of what we're talking about here. So I'm going to put up a chart here of high yield debt yields. High yield debt, as Lance said, is just sort of a kind way of saying junk debt, if you've ever heard of junk debt. These are the companies that are the most risky companies. So this is the current yields that the market's demanding for holding its debt. And as you'll see here, a year ago, just to show you how crazily mispriced this market became in terms of just not worrying about risk, high yield debt yields were under 4%, Lance.
Yeah.
I mean, guys, that is like treating the riskiest of companies with the same confidence of like a 30-year U.S. Treasury bond. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And
I just think you need to break that down just a little bit, because it's such an important point you're making. And I don't think people really understand it, because they go, well, 4%, because of what the Fed did by suppressing interest rates to zero, you know, we pushed everybody into chasing yield, right? It's like, oh my God, I can't have money sitting in money market at zero. I need to go get something on my money. So everybody started buying high yield stocks, high yield bonds. And again, high yield is a marketing term. If I came to you and said, hey, Adam, I got this great junk bond fund, you know, I'm the next junk bond king. Would you like to buy my junk bond fund? Everybody's like, no, I don't want junk bonds. Okay. Hey, I got this great high yield fund. You want to buy it? It's got a high yield. Oh, I'm all in, right? Just that's better than money market. Give me that. That's all that happened on Wall Street, right? They just repackaged it, kind of like ESG investing. So, but the what yields tell you. So, just, and we explained this a little bit before, but I think it's such an important point to make here, is that what yields account for is I'm loaning somebody money for a period of time. And as a lender of that money, I want to calculate several things. One, I need to calculate the rate of inflation. I need to calculate the risk that I'm going to get paid back or not, right? So I'm going to loan Adam money. Is he going to pay me back? Maybe he's a good credit, maybe he's not. If he's not, I need to get compensated for that risk. In other words, the yield is supposed to be compensating me for that risk. And when you're looking at triple C junk bonds yielding, and by the way, triple C is like right on the verge of, they're going to go default any day now.
Right.
You know, how much, if I came to you and I said, Adam, you know, I wanted to borrow some money for you. And I go, and you go, Lance, I know you're broke. You don't have a house to live in. You live out of your car and you have no job. You're going to say, yeah, I'll loan you money, but it's going to be like 10%, right? 15%. It's going to be a very high rate, because the goal is to use that high yield to get as much of your principal back before he defaults. That's what that yield is supposed to be calculating. At 4% for a company about to go into bankruptcy is ridiculous, but that's what we did to, that's how deformed the market became because of what the Federal Reserve did. And people don't equate the risk to the yield. And that's the big thing that investors miss. They're buying these high yield instruments because they're marketed as high yield, but the yield is the risk. That's your compensation for risk you're taking. And is it really worth 4% to lose half your money or more? That's the way you need to be thinking about these things, but people don't, because so far nothing's gone wrong. And when we should have had a bunch of defaults back in March of 2020, when we shut the government down, we should have had a lot of junk bonds going to default. We didn't, because the Fed started buying junk bonds.
Exactly.
And that should have cleansed the system of a lot of those zombies, and we didn't.
We didn't. And just like we should have cleansed the banking system of the big, too big to fail banks, and we didn't. We rescued everybody, right? So I'm glad you're emphasizing this, because it really making a point I made a couple months ago that is now coming true now, where we were railing about the same market deformations that the Fed is responsible for. And I use the analogy that the Fed was pushing people out onto thinner and thinner ice as they were striving for yield, because all of the safer investments that were built on really thick ice weren't yielding anything, right? So if you're a senior, you need to get some return to make some money off of, or you're a fund manager and you've got a benchmark you got to try to hit. Well, you know, you have to go out into these riskier and riskier products to get yield. And with the Fed out there, where the Fed was basically continuing to put all this stimulus and liquidity into the system, it worked. And so people got pushed out into further and further onto thinner and thinner ice. And because so much time had passed without an adverse event, they began treating that thin ice with the confidence that it was concrete, right? Yeah. And the risk is that some point you break through and now you're way out in the middle of the lake and, you know, you're in deep water, right? You're in big trouble. So I want to bring up the chart here again of the high yield bonds, because we're seeing that play out in real time right now. A year ago, they were yielding under 4%. Now they're yielding almost 9% just a year later, right? So, you know, the prices of this debt's getting zorched. I don't know what the default rate's like, but I got to assume it's going up, or at least risk of defaults going up here. So all of a sudden, all those folks that are, you know, now sitting on a bunch of high yield debt that they bought a year ago are saying, this is actually not a very good deal at all.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, all these people that bought, high yield ETFs are deeply, deeply underwater now and going, well, that didn't work out like I thought. And you know, that's the other issue of this is that, say, for instance, and what people don't understand about yield is like, well, yeah, you know, I'm down in it, but I'm getting 9%. No, you're not. You get the yield that you got when you bought it. Because if, for instance, if a ETF is issued out at 10 bucks and it pays a dollar dividend, or a dollar interest payment, you have a 10% yield at $10. If it falls to 5% or to $5, you've lost 50% of your money. And yes, now the yield is 20%, but you're still only getting the dollar. So, you know, the yield doesn't equate to your capital loss and your return on investment. The only thing that matters is what's that dollar dividend being paid into you. So you can sit there and look at it all day long and go, yeah, I'm getting a 20% yield or whatever it is. But no, you've lost 50% of your money, and there's a big risk you're going to lose a whole lot more before this is over, particularly if those underlying companies, like Adam was just talking about here, start to go bankrupt. And again, when you take a look at the small and mid-cap space, the Russell 2000, there's a large contingent of those companies that, as Adam pointed out earlier, are what we call zombie companies, and they're about to run into a very big problem here. And I think we're going to see bankruptcy start to pick up next year.
Well, I think we have to, because as that chart showed, their cost of debt just doubled in a year, right? Yeah. I mean, a lot of those companies can't withstand that. And just to make this even more relevant and understandable to just the average consumer, is we have the same thing that's largely happened with mortgages, right? Mortgages were under 3% last August, and now they're close to 6. They actually were at 6. They've cooled off just a tiny bit. But, you know, that knocks a ton of people out of the mortgage market, because they just can't afford a mortgage at that rate, or prices have to come down to make them affordable again.
Right. And that's kind of an interesting thing too, because, you know, so far we haven't seen a lot of price deterioration yet in houses, but I think it's coming. Houses are sitting on the markets a lot longer. We're starting to see, you know, inventories, supplies starting to go up rather sharply. And there's a lot of people, I think we talked about this last week, you know, there's a lot of people saying, yeah, the housing market's going to stay elevated. You know, I don't know how that occurs.
I don't know.
Because
I think those people are wrong. I'll be that direct. I think they're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, it's never happened before, by the way. And by the way, you also have the biggest gap now. You know, when you go back and look at housing versus long-term trend or housing prices versus incomes, we had a huge gap between incomes and prices back in 2008. We have an even bigger gap this time around. So I don't know how you don't have a really big reversion here at some point. I know everybody's saying, well, this time is different. We don't have subprime debt. you know, I don't think you have to have subprime debt to have a big reversion in house prices. It could be wrong, but I just don't see how the math doesn't work, right? And I think that if interest rates stay up, the Fed keeps hiking rates, you're going to have a bigger reversion in house prices. And back to inflation, that's 42% of your inflation calculation.
Absolutely. And folks, look, if you're interested in more detail on this, watch the video here that I recently recorded with Nick Jurley, the housing analyst. We go really into deep into a lot of the things that Lance just mentioned. And Lance actually just talked to Nick over the weekend, and he's even more bearish than he was back in that video where he was calling for sort of a national 30% price correction in the market because things continue to deteriorate as fast as you're saying here. And you and I can make that argument minus a recession and job losses. But let's say we get a serious recession with millions of people losing their jobs again. That just places a whole bunch of additional downward gravity onto housing prices. And so anyways, folks, I hope I've made the point without just completely beating the horse to death. But that's why cost of capital is so important. The same way it pulls down housing prices in the housing market, it pulls down corporate profits and mathematically then has to pull down equity valuation. So that could and should be the next big shoe to drop here. We're not going to have too much longer to wait to determine whether Lance and I are correct on this because these earning reports are going to start coming out starting in the next couple of weeks. We've even seen a couple, you and I were talking last week about Micron, which was a classic example of this. They crushed their Q2 numbers, yet the stock got pummeled because their forward guidance was revised downwards so strongly, right?
And I think you're going to see a lot of that. I think the earnings will come in. I think the revenue will hit numbers because everybody's kind of been adjusting for that over the last 3 months. But I think after that, I think potentially these forward calculations and forward estimates are really going to come down because of these reports that are going to come out. I think there's going to be a lot more bearishness to it than people think.
Okay, so I want to get to your recent trades, but real quick,
just before we jump off yields, one thing that we watch on for yields in particular is the spread between either investment grade bonds, say like an A-rated corporate bond, and a triple B rated bond, and a double B rated bond. So if you look at bonds, they have all these different ratings. And one of the things that we track fairly closely is we look at spreads between different risk ratings, right? So take a look at the yield on an A-rated corporate bond versus a double B-rated bond, right? A junk bond. When you start heading into recession, those spreads start to really widen out. And we're starting to finally see that. We're starting to see a lot of these corporate bond spreads starting to increase in size, particularly talking about your high yield side. We're starting to see that occur. So that's one of your warning signs that you're heading towards a recession. Now, when that happens and you start to see the spread in corporates blow out, you'll start to see money rotating to 10-year treasuries for safety. And we're seeing that as well. 10-year treasury yields have been coming down here over the last couple of weeks as concerns about recession are starting to pick up and we're starting to see these yield spreads start to blow out.
That's a great point. And just on the 10-year alone, it got as high as about 3.5% or so, and it's now down to like 2.8 or something like that, if I'm doing the math right. Yeah. That's a pretty substantial swing in such a short period of time here. So everything you're saying is true and really merits our attention here. All right. So the question I was going to ask is, as you said, everybody is sort of poised for, okay, so when is the Fed going to pivot? Then I'm going to, whatever cash I have on the sidelines, I'm coming back in, right?
Leverage the house,
right. And as I think I said to you back in like February, the big question of this year is going to be how much backbone does the Fed have, right? Like, is it going to hike for longer than most people expect, or is it going to pivot sooner as many people expect, right? And there are lots of people all over the map with their own particular predictions on this. But what I wonder is, as you like to say, when everybody is expecting something to happen, it either doesn't happen or it doesn't happen the way that people expect. Right. And what I'm wondering is you saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great movie. At the very end of the movie, the Nazis get exactly what they want. They get the Ark of the Covenant. They open it up. The angel comes out. The guy yells, "It's beautiful," right? And gets everything he wants. And then all of a sudden, everything goes to hell. right? Like literally the angel turns into this avenging angel. Guys' faces melt, all the zombies get fried, right? So awesome, it's kind of a be careful what you wish for, right? Because it might actually not be the way you think it is. Could we be setting up the market here for disappointment? In other words, could Powell pivot and it actually play out totally differently than what most people are thinking? Because in most people's minds, it's okay, Powell pivots and we just go back to the same script we were been on the past decade. Equities go to the moon, you know, buy the dips, let it rip, just be long everything forever. Could we get the pivot without all the paradise?
Two things is that, okay, so first of all, I think the Fed's got to hike more first. The reason is that A, earnings haven't corrected yet. And so that's giving, as I said earlier, there's a big correlation between the Fed and earnings decline. So once earnings start to decline, the Fed's going to become much more cautious about hiking rates. So right now, earnings are giving them kind of the room that they need to hike rates. And as I said before, the Fed needs to hike rates right now, not because of inflation, right? And if the Fed did nothing, inflation would take care of itself over time. High prices cures high prices. We've been through this analogy. So the Fed, though, they realize that a recession's coming. They're at least smart enough to know that. And that in the event of a recession, the only tool that really works in terms of getting the economy going again is lowering interest rates back to zero, right? Because if you bring mortgage rates down, you bring car rates down, you bring credit card rates down, it opens up the credit market. People can go borrow money cheaper. They go buy stuff with that money and you get the economy going again. So the Fed's got to get off of this 0% interest rate structure they were on for way too long and get that rate up to 2, 2.25, 2.5 to give them some room in order to lower rates. So that's the race against time that the Fed has right now. The question is whether or not the market's going to give it to them. So if the, you know, and so the your to your question, what if the Fed gets to 2, 2.5, 2.25, whatever it is, and they go, we're done, no more hiking rates, and all of a sudden the markets don't go up? Well, the reason that the markets may not go up and respond as everybody expects is if inflation hasn't come down yet. And all of a sudden, it's going to be the Fed has now, the loss of confidence in the Fed will be, we still have inflation. The Fed is stopping their fight against inflation to bail out the market, but this inflation isn't going away. And now you're going to exacerbate inflation by lowering rates while you have inflation. So that's the big risk to the Fed, is that the markets don't respond to the Fed lowering rates because of inflation, because we haven't had inflation like this in 40 years. So there's a big unknown here between what the Fed does and whether or not they instigate QE when you have 7, 8, 9% inflation. That's the one unknown, because we haven't had that during the entire time that the Fed's been doing QE and keeping zero interest rates.
Yeah. And as I think we've talked about a bit, you know, when I had Bill Fleckenstein on this program last, he predicts that when the Fed does pivot, that that's when it's going to lose the bond market, where rates on the long end are going to continue going up. They're not going to go down, even though the Fed is easing and bringing down the Fed funds rate, because the market, the bond market has basically said, you guys have just proven that you're ineffectual clowns. You can't get inflation under control. We don't think you ever will. And we're going to be demanding higher yields to compensate us for this risk. Look, nobody knows what's going to happen here, but I'm just going to ask you to kind of just prognosticate. I mean, what do you think the odds are that the actual results of a Fed pivot will be different from what most investors are hoping for right now? Is it a small risk? Is it a large risk?
It's hard to quantify. And the reason I say it's hard to quantify, and I'm not trying to avoid the question, is the honest answer is I don't know. The reason is I say that is that we have spent 12 years now training an entire market to buy the freaking dip, right? So as soon as the Fed pivots, you buy stocks. And I think that's going to be, look, there's been a good bit of selling this year. If we take a look at cash holdings for a lot of institutions, they're at fairly high levels. You know, so there's what they call, it's not money on the sidelines. That's a complete myth. There is no such thing, but there's a lot of cash sitting on books that needs to get invested. And the question is when does it get invested? So, you know, and we just train people so much to do this, right? So a lot of the retail investors have been wiped out. So all of those, you know, $1,400 stimmy checks and, you know, millionaire kids that we made in 2020, 2021, that's pretty much been wiped out now. So that's not there and that's not coming back because they can't generate more money. So a lot of the money that's out there is going to be money for institutions, pensions, hedge fund managers, et cetera, that are sitting on fairly big cash pots. I mean, we're holding almost 35% cash now. So, you know, we've got cash to invest. The question is just when do we deploy that asset back into the equity markets? And so we trained people for 12 years now that as soon as the Fed starts to do QE, you just buy stocks. It's just like an automatic reflex. So I think that'll happen. And then what'll happen is they'll all jump in. The market keeps going down and everybody goes, oh my God, what just happened? And then they all bail out again. And now you've completely broken the system at that point. You know, that's the risk. The risk is everybody jumps in, the market keeps going down, and then you've completely broken the whole mindset. And then what happens after that, I don't think is anything good.
All right. All right. Well, you know, look, as you said, nobody knows, and we'll be tracking this every week. So folks, we'll be giving you audibles all along the way. But it does sound, Lance, that you sort of share my concern that even if the majority of the market gets what it wants, the playbook may not play out the way that they're assuming it is right now.
Yeah. And look, and this is, and just from a portfolio management point of view, and this is the way we look at things is look, we're going to buy, if the Fed came out tomorrow and says, hey, we're done hiking rates, we'll probably put some capital to work in the market. Just because of that's kind of what history tells us that we need to be doing. But ultimately, we're going to be watching the technical indicators and things in the market that we can then look back on and say, okay, yeah, 3 weeks ago, there was a clear bottom in the market. We've seen volumes pick up on the positive side. We've got all these indicators on a weekly basis and a monthly basis that are now back on the buy signals. And so we've got a fairly clear entry point. We're going to be late. We're going to miss the bottom, right? But once the markets start trending more positively, we're going to be a lot more comfortable about putting money back to work and taking on risk. And that way, if something happens and, you know, the markets bounce initially off the Fed rate hike and then start going down dramatically lower, that's okay because the technicals will tell us that. So if we just pay attention to the price in the markets, we should be able to navigate that. You're going to miss the bottom. You're not going to buy the bottom. You're going to be late getting in. But at that point, you're going to have a much higher confidence rate about what's going to happen over the next 12 months as markets start to get back on their feet.
Right, right. As David Rosenberg said, leave the bottom picking to the proctologists.
Exactly. Yeah. Only he would say that.
All right. Well, look, I did say I was going to ask you about trades that you guys have made, not just this week, but last week too. So what you got?
So last week, we haven't done any this week, and I don't suspect we will. Today's only Wednesday, but again, you know, we're kind of watching this market. Last week, we added three very small positions. Just we bought a position in the Qs, and we balanced that tech position with an equal weighted S&P index. And so we kind of just married those two together. We added about 5% of our portfolio into those two ETFs strictly for a trade. What we were looking for is kind of the end of the quarter rebalancing, first of the second half, kind of people wanting to put money to work. That's been happening a little bit here. So those positions have been adding a bit. We also bought a 1% position in Devon Energy. Energy's been really beaten down. We were a little bit early on our trade, but it's a feeder position. As we've talked about before, when we buy a position, we buy a little bit, see if the position works and our thesis is playing out. Oil prices have gotten really beaten up. You know, we were writing articles about 5-6 weeks ago talking about, you know, time to take profits out of energy. We were selling some energy stocks, taking that profit out. And, you know, because we said, look, what's going to happen is that oil prices where they are, they're going to correct. And we had a very big correction. Oil prices, a lot of energy stocks got really beat up. And Devon Energy, which has about a 5% yield on it, ExxonMobil, Marathon, a lot of these companies have had very big declines back to longer term moving averages. They're kind of flirting with the bottom right now. So we're giving it a little bit of room here, but we think there's a tradable opportunity. There's too many people that are long energy that are still optimistic that energy prices can't do anything but go up. They're wrong. But there's a lot of bullish sentiment in that space for right now. So I think there's room for a trade on the energy side, and then we'll be out of that one again.
Okay, great. Resource stocks have gotten hit fairly substantially over the past
not just resources, agriculture, across the commodity index.
I meant sort of hard assets, commodities, et cetera.
Yeah.
And part of that, there's a couple reasons for that. One is just demand destruction, mm-hmm. right? So we all see it. You and I have talked about this a lot. So some people are looking out and saying, okay, there's probably gonna be a little bit less demand. And these things have performed really well this year because they had massive demand due to supply shortages and stuff like that. You tie that to, the fears of a recession, which is just going to make demand equation even worse, right? But also the dollar has continued to strengthen into this,
as you would expect.
Yeah, and that tends to, as people get more concerned about disinflation, deflation, whatever, too, you would expect the dollar to strengthen, and so. That tends to have a seesaw relationship with commodities here. So I'm just curious what your team's sort of thoughts on the dollar are here, because obviously that could play a role here too. There's some people who are calling, they expect the dollar to weaken pretty substantially going forward. And if that were true, that probably would have a beneficial effect on a lot of these commodity plays. But there's a lot of other factors going on as well. So I'm just curious, what is your team thinking of the dollar?
Well, so you have to remember that the dollar doesn't live in isolation, right? And I was arguing with a guy at the beginning of 2021. He writes for Market Watch, and he's like, oh, the dollar is going to zero, and it's going to be great for all these other assets. I'm like, no, it's not true. I said the dollar is going to get a lot stronger, and as the economy gets weaker, this is going to continue to be the case. It was interesting because earlier this year I was talking to a guy. He listens to the Wealthy On channel a lot, listens to all the interviews, and he called me up. He's like, Lance, the dollar's going to zero and commodities are going to the moon. And he didn't agree with any of my thesis, right? That's not going to be the case. And, he went long all these, kind of commodity, anti-dollar plays, and he's paid a heavy price for that since then. And the reason that I say all this, and this is important, is to always keep in context that the dollar isn't going to go to zero as a function, because it's just relative to other currencies. And so when you take a look at the dollar, it's what is the dollar relative to the Japanese yen? What is the dollar relative to the Russian ruble? What's the dollar relative to the Chinese yuan, right? So we look at this, and typically we look at the dollar as the dollar against a basket of currencies, right? So that's how we look at a trade-weighted basket. We say, okay, this is what the value of the dollar is relative to that. Okay, understanding that, the basic idea is just understanding that if I live in another country, right, and especially if I live in the Eurozone right now, ain't nothing good going on, as they say, in the Eurozone. And all the decisions that the ECB made are coming home to roost in a very big way in Europe. And the euro, if you take a look at the euro is approaching parity to the US dollar. That's the first time that's been the case since it was issued back in 2000. So, the whole run up in the euro over years has completely been wiped out in about the last 12 months. And this is as a function, as those economies get weaker, they have inflation, they have weaker economic growth. And if I'm sitting on that currency over there, I've got to go, man, I've got to do something with this to do what, right? Protect my purchasing power parity. I need to get that money somewhere else. Where am I going to go where I can get a yield on my return and have a stronger capital investment? It's the US dollar. So people buy treasuries. They flow into US dollars. They buy treasuries with those dollars. That's where they shield their reserves. Japan has a huge problem right now. And, they've been buying their own government bonds. They own the majority of their bond market. And we've been talking about for a while. We said, look, this ends badly for Japan at some point. It's just a function of time. Well, guess what? We're there. And now you're starting to see the implications of that. So if you got Japanese yen, where are you going to put them? US dollar. And so basically, as we said, we were talking about, kind of joking about this last time, all roads lead, right now back to the US dollar and the US treasury. So the last thing I'd be betting against right now today is for a big decline in the US dollar. And the reason is where are you going to go with the dollars? right? If you're going to take money out of the US dollar, where are you going with it? Are you going to go to the Russian ruble? Are you going to go to the euro? You know what? And in order for the euro to be, I'm not saying that's not going to happen, by the way, but in order for me to take money out of the dollar and go into the euro, which has been really beaten up here, I've got to be expecting that I'm about to have economic recovery in the euro and the eurozone. And that's not the case right now. Now, that'll be down the road when we get through whatever this global recession looks like. Then we'll see the dollar come down and money go back into the euro for that recovery. But that's not today.
Okay, great. And really, everything that you're laying out there is pretty much the playbook for Brent Johnson's dollar milkshake theory. And folks, if you're watching and you're not familiar with what that is, watch this interview here that I did with Brent a year ago, where he just walks through that theory. And it's pretty much been playing out ever since he shared it back then.
And that's, by the way, that's an awesome interview. I highly Thank encourage you. Yeah, everyone well, to watch
it. It has been one of, that theory has been one of the most, has had one of the greatest explanatory powers of any framework that I've been using this year, just sort of in you know, helping understand how things have been unfolding so far. All right. So, all right, let's get to our rant as we begin to wrap up here.
I thought we've been doing that for an hour now.
Yeah, we kind of have. We've been on simmer. Maybe we can get it up to a low boil right here. And we don't have to spend too much time on this, but I think this is something that's near to your heart, Lance. We'll see. But it's funny, when you and I started planning on potentially, you know, partnering together here with Wealthion and your firm, you would tease me, and I think deservedly so. I understood where you're coming from, that you know, man, Adam, you're so
love.
Bearish.
A place yeah, of love,
all,
Adam.
It's all love. Yeah, actually, I knew it was probably more jealousy than anything else. But, you know, you would sort of tease me about having a bearish outlook. And, you know, I liked to try to say, hey, it's not a philosophy, right? I'm just doing it because the macro data that I look at makes me worried. And I know you to be a very empirical and data-driven guy as well, Lance. And don't let me put words in your mouth. But I would say that our macro views have increasingly aligned as this year has gone along. And I think both of us at times kind of get painted with the, you're just a perma bear, right? You know,
oh, yeah.
Which we aren't. We're just saying, look, the data as we see it right now, yes, makes us more pessimistic about a lot of things, but we'd love to be optimists. We'd love to be bullish. Like, we're just waiting for, you know, valid data that makes us want to take that side of the argument. We're just not seeing it right now, right? And I mentioned all this not to say, oh, woe is us, we get mischaracterized, but I say it to kind of contrast us with, there are, sometimes people will say, you guys are just selling fear, right? And that really bothers me, because that's not what we're doing at all. We're just literally trying to say, look, this is the data as we see it. And we're trying to build awareness amongst people that aren't getting this data in maybe more mainstream channels. And we're just trying to say, hey, folks, here's important information we think you should look at and take into consideration for whatever decision you make down the road. You can dismiss it if you find, you know, better information elsewhere, you think, great, that's up to you. But we just want to make sure that you're aware of this data that we're seeing, right? Now, there are people out there in our industry, and I'm not going to name names, who really are kind of merchants of fear, that their business models are more predicated on, I'm just going to come up with the most salacious headline that gets clicks and views, and it gets people spun up and scared. And, you know, I'm going to monetize that in some way. You know, some do it through a premium subscription, some do it through selling other types of stuff. But, you know, as this year has become rockier and more anxiety producing for everybody, just given what's been going on, you know, I do see some people out there that are really sort of exploiting that. That really just bugs me. So anyways, that's my rant for this video, Lance. I'm sure you've got some thoughts on this. So what do you think?
So no, it's right. And, you know, this is, you know, one thing, like, if you follow me on Twitter, you know, go to @LanceRoberts and on Twitter, shameless plug. I need followers.
And folks should go there.
I need followers. So come on, joking. One thing I try to do is every morning I post 5 or 6 tweets in the morning. I really hate social media. So I just go on and post 5 or 6, you know, important points for the day. And then I'm done for the day. I don't look at it till the next day. But you know, when I try to balance that, right? So I'll, like this morning I posted one that says, look, you know, after the first, when you have really negative first halves of the year, the second half of the year tends to be positive more often than not, right? So I try to balance, you know, good news and bad news and perspectives, because one of the things, and this is one thing that I even try with you, is that, yes, you know, our thought processes align a lot right now. And that's bothersome to me a little bit, because the one thing that, and I don't mean that, no, I don't mean that.
Because the last guy you want to agree with is this.
Yeah, no, that's not what I mean. The trap I try to avoid, and this is the thing I really want to do for all the people watching your videos, is to avoid confirmation bias.
Yeah, and group.
That's the biggest trap we fall into. I ran down the rabbit hole with this guy earlier this week on climate change, right? And you know, and I don't even have a dog in the hunt for climate change, but I've got, you know, I can do math, right? I can figure a lot of stuff out through math. But you know, he was so tied into groupthink. Right. This is what all the scientists say. Well, you know, all the scientists he quote are kind of all in the same camp. Right. If you all believe that this is the outcome you want, then all of your data aligns to support that outcome. You're not learning anything. All you're doing is just getting this group thing.
Yeah. You're just confirming your bias. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what, to your point, that's what confirmation bias is. So, you know, like earlier you asked me, you know, in the show, and you're like, well, you know, if the Fed does this, you know, what do you think is going to happen? And you know, I try to balance that answer with, you know, hey, I think the markets could go up if they pivot, but then they could also go down. And I know that's not a great answer, but the truth is that nobody knows what's going to happen. So it's important that we try to say, okay, what's the optimistic outcome and what's the pessimistic outcome, and balance those two, because here's the outcome, right, that you're shooting for. Let's just say that you're a permable, right? Because there's plenty of guys out there right now. They're always bullish, and it's great because the majority of the time markets go up more so than they go down. So they're right more often than they're wrong. The problem is that when you're wrong, you lose a whole bunch of your capital. And it's really hard to get that capital back. You know, in 2008, we lost 50% of our accounts. And, you know, and so that you lost 50% of your money, and it took till, you know, 2015 to get that money back. And that's just assuming you weren't any companies that went bankrupt, because if you were in those companies, you never got your money
back.
That
money does never come back. Exactly.
Exactly. And we always forget about survivor bias when we talk about, you know, indexes and, you know, getting back to even and those type of things. But you know, if I'm bearish, right? What's the worst outcome of me being bearish, right? The worst outcome is I miss making money, right?
You miss the party.
I miss the party, but I don't lose my capital. And I can always go to the party, right? I might be late to the party, and Adam's always fashionably late because he shows up in like flowered suits and stuff like that. But you know, he's always late. He makes a big entrance, but you know, that's okay, because you can still participate in the markets. And so being bearish doesn't necessarily have a major negative consequence that being always bullish has. And so the point of the conversation and the point you're making, which is we need to take, look, economic realities are economic realities, doesn't mean the markets have to actually, you know, correlate as they have in the past to what the economic environment is now. The markets could do something different. Now, they've never done it before, but, you know, something could happen this time, right? You know, we could have some outcome that we haven't previously expected. And we just need to be able to counter that in our portfolio management, saying, look, I'm weighted in a manner that if the market goes up, I can participate. I won't make as much as the market, but if the market falls out from underneath my feet, I'm not going to get hurt as much either. And it gives me time to make better decisions about where to allocate capital next. And this is the big problem with passive investing and buy and hold, which is, you know, I'm just going to ride this market up and down, and I hope it all works out over time. And the problem with passive investing and buy and hold, and again, if it worked, 80%, as we talked about last week, Adam, 80% of Americans wouldn't be living paycheck to paycheck if passive investing actually worked.
Right. All right. Look, I think you've actually helped me sort of tease this into two separate points, at least two points that I want to make. One is that, Lance, I think you saw, did you see The Social Dilemma that was on Netflix? Yeah. It was all about social media and the evils of it, but it really went into confirmation bias, right? That we get our social media allows us to get just the news we want from the sources that think like us, right? So we're just always having our biases reaffirmed, right? And that's bad in every case, I think. And so, you know, Wealthion's mission is to make investors better informed so that they can then make smarter decisions. We try to help connect them with resources and solutions to make those insights actionable, right? And if you're watching this video, by definition, you're a Wealthion viewer. But I would say to you guys, don't just rely on Wealthion. Like literally, you know, go out there and seek other sources and push yourself to read a few sources that disagree with the points being made by the majority of experts on here, just so you can take them into consideration and come up with your reasons for why you don't agree with them, or maybe you do. And if you do, you can shift your thinking. But it's important to understand why you're, if you're not taking a course of action, it is better to understand why you're not taking it than you're just taking a course of action that a trusted source of yours is saying to go do. So at the end of the day, I want to make you better informed investors, and that is taking in a collection of hopefully smart, good, empirical sites. Don't just rely on this website.
That's why you need to get Jim Cramer on for an interview.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? I'd like to. I mean, I really would. Ideally, I'd love to get, I'd love to get a Fed chair. I don't think I'm going to get Powell, but it'd be great to get, you know, a previous one on here, not to beat them up, but literally just try to understand what's inside their minds and makes them tick. And maybe there are some key nuggets in there that we just haven't thought of yet, but.
I wasn't being, you know, salacious by saying, giving Jim Cramer. What I'm saying he's always bullish. And this is the thing, you know, with realinvestmentadvice.com, you know, I get pegged a lot as like, oh, Lance, you're all, everything you write, you're always bearish. Well, the reason I write that way is, and I'm not being bearish. And if you read the articles that are more analytical in nature, generally what I'm doing is I'm attacking, not attacking, that's a bad word. I'm countering some bullish opinion. Look, you can watch CNBC all day long and all you get is, you know, the bullish, you know, everything's going to be fine. Just invest, you know, buy dips and whatever. You know, there's so many bullish outlets because that's the easy trade to make, right? Just be bullish. Don't worry about the downturn in the market. And that's easy to say when things are always going up, right? 2020, 2021. I mean, right. You know, I wrote articles about, you know, the retail traders and that, you know, this was, you know, one of the articles I wrote was about experience being a teacher. And, you know, there's a man with money meets a man with experience. Man with experience leaves with money, right? The man with money leaves with experience. I said, this is what's going to happen with retail traders 2 years later. Here we are, right? And so a lot of the articles we write, and in fact, I'm writing a couple of articles coming out next week about the bullwhip effect and talking about earnings recessions and these type of things, because that's not what you're hearing on the mainstream media. So, you know, I kind of set myself up as trying to be the contrarian in terms of investment analysis of, as opposed to the mainstream media, because what the mainstream media sells you is what sells advertising. Mutual fund companies, hedge funds, they're not going to advertise on CNBC if you're bashing their product.
Right. Okay. And I'm interrupting because I said there were two points. The first one is don't be in just a silo, you know, listen to a bunch of disparate voices and then make up your own mind. Yeah. The second one is to be aware, and this is sort of what I was kicking this off with, is to be aware that there are sources out there that have an intentional bias, right? So you gave a great example of CNBC. They are pretty much always going to be bullish, or they're always going to search for the bullish spin to the story because their business model depends on it. You know, all those players that you just mentioned, mutual funds, advertisers, et cetera, they're not going to spend those ad dollars if CNBC is out there basically saying the conditions that are bad for their products are what's likely to happen next, right?
Yeah, being in cash doesn't create revenue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, so you're highly likely to not hear those guys on CNBC say, "Hey guys, now's a great time to get into cash," right? Because they're literally being told by their advertisers and by the editors in chief of like, no, you got to go out there, you got to pump stocks, buddy. And then secondly, there are, you know, information sites, and I'm more aware of the ones that are on the internet, where, like I said, people are selling an emotion. And I think in our case, in our world, our sphere, I tend to notice the guys that are out there selling overly pessimistic content, simply because they know it stirs people up, and, you know, fear drives views, fear drives clicks, et cetera. And you want to be really careful of those people, because, you know, nothing's ever 100% good or 100% bad. Yes, there's a lot of reasons to be defensive right now. And I would say Lance and I are, you know, we're very bearish about current market conditions, but we are always on the lookout for opportunities to tell you that, hey, you know, you can always find opportunity in good and bad markets. And we believe, and I think we calculate that there will come a time where there's going to be a preponderance of great opportunities here. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to help you keep your capital intact long enough to be able to take advantage of those things. So my big sort of admonishment there is just really consider the motivations of the source of your information, because there are certain players out there whose motivations are, they're not in alignment with your interests. They're simply in alignment with their pocketbooks and how they make money.
Right. And look, there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, look, fair game.
Well, I think
right?
There's something wrong with it, but.
Well, what I mean by that is look, fair game. You know, my partners and I run a, you know, $1+ billion investment advisory firm. And so the reason I spend an hour with you every week is I hope that the message that goes out there appeals to somebody listening and they want to come employ our services to manage their money. That's how I get paid. That's how I make my living. Right. You know, and that needs to be clear, because, you know, I don't want to sit there and go, well, CNBC is bad because, you know, they advertise for people and they're promoting a bullish view all the time. That's the business, right? That's the business that we're all in. And ultimately what we have to do as consumers is try to parse through that to make sure that we're getting the right information. And this is to your point. I wrote an article about this, about how, you know, trying to avoid a crash is worse in a lot of cases than going through the crash. And this is the problem that a lot of people are going to run into. They are now, because the market's down this year, they're gravitating towards people with really bearish outlooks, right? The world's coming to an end. You know, we're going to have, you know, we're going to become the next Weimar Republic in the US. The dollar's going to zero. Commodities are going to go to the moon. We're never going to have any, all the shelves are going to be empty. We're, you know, never going to have any food to eat. Right. And, you know,
buy your share in my nuclear missile silo that's been converted into an end of days bunker. Right. Yeah.
Or in this case, you know, you got to be in my fund that is short everything. Right. You know, I'm 100% long commodities and I'm short everything else. And that's great. And that's going to all work fine for about 6 months. And then once disinflation sets back in and the economy starts to go through its cycle, and we go through that recessionary process and start to come out the other side, you're going to be in a position where not only are you going to lose a lot of your money, you're not going to get any recovery back, right? And it takes a long time for people to come to realization that they're in the wrong game. And, you know, John Hussman is a great, I mean, super intelligent guy. And I think he's one of the smartest guys out there in terms of, you know, analytics and understanding this, but, you know, he's gotten beat up for years because from 2009 to 2020, his fund grossly underperformed the rest of the market. So I was like, well, why do you want to be in his fund? Because, you know, it's just gone down while the rest of the market went up. And, you know, he got tagged with that kind of an idea, but his thesis is correct. And there will be a point, his is the fund you want to be in times like this, right? He's been making money this year because of the way his fund is positioned. But there's going to be a time that the markets are going to change again. So what's important is that as investors, we have to understand the market that we're in and not get tied into one view that doesn't ever change. That your view has to be flexible with the markets and with the economy and with potential outcomes, because our job as investors is to make money, preserve our capital, but to also make money, because our whole job of investing is to do one thing only, which is to make sure that our savings outpace the rate of inflation, so our purchasing power parity remains the same in the future as it is today. That's our whole goal. And trying to get any other return outside the rate of inflation. Now, right now, you're just like, Lance, I need 8%. that's not going to stay that way. But, you know, over time, inflation is going to run about 2.5%. So any rate of return that you try to get above 2.5% to beat inflation, just call it 3%. Any rate of return you want about, so if you want to go from 3% return to 4% return, that's a 25% increase in the rate of return, right? So that you're trying to get. The problem is that you don't employ risk of just 25% increase. It's almost a 100% increase to generate that additional 1 point rate of return. There's an exponential increase in risk. And so the more risk you take, the more potential for loss that you have. And this is where people eventually err over time, is they get too much risk in the portfolio when markets are going up. And as you know, as the old saying goes, when the tide goes out, we all find out who's swimming naked. Well, we find out a lot of people were swimming naked this year because they took on way too much risk because of 2020, 2021. So the short answer to all of them, I apologize for the lengthy dialogue here, but you know, the short answer is that you have to measure what it is you're trying to do, and don't get trapped into one side of the story, because that story will change. And yeah, you may avoid the downturn, but then you miss the 400% advance in the market over the next decade. And that was actually worse than going through the decline in the first place.
Okay. Well, this is a good segue into the next and final updates I'm going to give folks of the live Q&A that we have coming up on Monday of next week. But just to quickly summarize, to put a period on the main point I wanted to make, we agree you should be consuming multiple forms of income, multiple forms of content, so that you're getting a diversified exposure to what's out there, and then zeroing in on what makes most sense to you. Lance, you just did a great job of sort of explaining why people need to be not to get attached to a philosophy, but instead to really calculate probabilities and then come up with a plan of action, so that if X happens, then you do Y, right? And you're not just being whipsawed around by your emotions, right? Totally agree with that. And you're making the case for why we refer people to financial advisors who get the macro picture that we're talking about, because you guys help people put those types of plans together. The last point I just want to make on this is just be aware that there are certain people out there who, you talked about, hey, everybody has a business. And yes, everybody has a business. But let me use your business as an example. Your business is to help people beat that rate of inflation over time in a risk appropriate manner, right? And yes, you've got to do marketing for it and all that type of stuff, but you have a mission that's a noble mission. There are some people out there whose mission is just to make money off an online audience, and they will sell cat food, you know, more if it would make them more money. They just happen to be selling this other product because it makes them a better return for right now, right? So you have people out there who are basically doing the opposite almost of what we're talking about, where they're just trying to inflame emotions because that drives their business model, right? And so I just want to make sure, you know, there are a minority of people that are out there in the space, but just if you're following a site that is just continually putting its finger on your fear button, that's a pretty good sign that you might want to just step back and question whether that information is really serving you over time. All right, so now to get to the point of the thing I want to put on people's radar here is that, yes, this coming Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have our monthly Ask Anything Q&A with Wealthion's endorsed financial advisors. So the guys from New Harbor will be there, and we're pretty sure Lance is going to be there. He's going to be on vacation in Italy. It's going to be late night his time, but we hope that he can make it. He's not too tired from all the Mai Tais and the pizza and the pasta.
I'm in Italy, not Mai Tais. So it's just going to be Vino in Italy. I'm going to be dressed like Mario probably, but.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, make sure you get a big burly mustache.
Exactly.
But hopefully Lance is going to have a good internet connection and still enough stamina to join us for that. We were supposed to do it this week, but we had the July 4th holiday, so we pushed it a week. So anyways, folks, we'll push out an email to everybody about that beforehand as a reminder. And if you're not yet on our email list, just go to wealthion.com/blog, which is where we post all of our videos and articles. But right there at the top of that page is a quick little email sign up. So if you're not on an email list, go there and sign up for that to make sure that as we send out future emails, you get them. But anyways, that again is going to be at 3 p.m. Eastern time, noon Pacific, this coming Monday. And then just in conclusion here, Lance, you and I talked last week about the retirement webinar that you and your team are going to be putting together for the Wealthion audience. I think when I mentioned this last week, at that time we'd had like 70 people who had sent us an email saying, hey, I'm interested, let me know when it's available. We're still locking in the date and time, folks, yet we don't have it yet, but we should have it by the time Lance gets back from vacation. Yep. But if you would like to be alerted and you haven't reached out to us yet, just send us an email at retirement@wealthion.com. And Lance, when I made this plug last week, I think we had like 70 people or so that had raised their hand for that. I think we're now close to 500. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of interest in this. Clearly a topic folks are interested in. A lot of people excited about this. But yes, yeah, folks.
And by the way, seating is limited. So you need to make sure and sign up now because this is your one chance.
Great. Exactly. So that's exactly what we're not about, folks. We will have as many seats, hopefully, as there are people that are interested. And this will be recorded too. So if you can't watch it live, everybody that registers for it will send you a replay video afterwards. But again, folks, if you want to make sure that you're alerted when we have registration open, just send an email to retirement@wealthion.com. All right. Well, look, Lance, have yourself a fantastic vacation. I wish it were longer for you. We'll look forward to seeing you on Monday. Hopefully we're not pulling you too much away from all the fun, but have a great time. Very well deserved. And whatever happens between now and then, we'll talk about it when you come back next week. I think you'll be back in time to do the market update. Maybe we'll take half of it just to get the highlights of what life in Italy is like. Everybody else, thanks so much for hanging with us through yet another update here. And we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for watching.